Welcome to the Public Services Reform Podcast from the Centres for Markets and Public Organisation. My name is Saskia Walcott, and today I'm talking to Mike Peacey. Mike is a lecturer at the New College of the Humanities in London and also a research fellow here at CMPO. Today he talks about some of his research in higher education, which he's working on with Jervis Huxley, a teaching fellow at the University of Bristol. Mike has two papers that are entitled The Technology of Learning and Self-Control at College. Interesting titles, Mike. What motivated you to look at higher education? And what has your work got to do with the tuition fee changes?
Okay, so I kind of think that higher education is quite under-researched relative to, for example, healthcares and schools. And, of course, tuition fees were introduced in 1998, and then they increased in 2006 and again in 2011. And how the incentives in higher education operate isn't particularly well understood. So then the impact of the fees, again, kind of needs some attention. So is it that they're promoting choice and competition within the universities, or are they just really an alternative way of funding higher education?
Okay. So in terms of your papers, is your work about how much students are studying, how they study and how much they're studying?
So it's not just about how much students study. Some other researchers have already kind of addressed that question. We're interested in both how much students study and how they use tuition. So our model really considers how students produce education. And it's quite surprising that these...
Do you mean how they educate themselves?
No, how they combine the two inputs, so how they combine study with tuition to produce a level of education or some knowledge. And of course, so the previous literature just focuses on using kind of one input, on just kind of saying, well, students spend some time studying or they have some kind of investment. But we really want to open up that model and kind of think about the different ways in which students can acquire this education.
Okay, so what are those different ways?
So it's basically just study and tuition. Using these kind of two inputs in a production function is really useful because the thing about study is it's got a time cost. So there's an opportunity cost of study, and tuition also has a time cost. So you need to spend an hour in a lecture. But in addition to that, it's got a monetary price to it. And being able to kind of look at two inputs which have time and money elements enabled us really to consider a variety of inputs that consist of different combinations of time and money. So it really enriches the framework for considering how people produce education, how students produce education.
Okay, so how does your approach relate to the pedagogy literature on learning styles?
Sure, so since our model is an attempt to look at how students learn, there's obviously a parallel with that literature. But the thing is, the phrase learning styles is usually associated with Gardner's work on multiple intelligence, and this work's kind of been discredited by the empirical literature. The reason for that is it kind of suggests that students only differ in terms of their learning style and there is no role for IQ, which we kind of think is wholly unreasonable. We think that even though students aren't identical, it's not just learning styles in how they differ. On the other hand, learning styles we think are important. So the idea that students learn in different ways can kind of, like I said, enrich the way that we think about how students learn. And in particular, we need to know how students learn. Even if everyone learns in the same way, we need to know the way that they use these two inputs, because that matters for the allocation of scarce resources.
So tell me, in what respect do universities provide the wrong amount of tuition for some students?
Okay, so students who are very independent learners, so who benefit a lot from studying on their own, and for whom tuition and study are highly substitutable, they might find that it's more efficient to learn through large amounts of self-study, so that's large amounts of studying on their own, and much smaller amounts of tuition. And this is essentially the argument that unis have used to justify low contact hours in the past. But there are two important points to remember. So this is only really relevant if tuition and study are not complementary. And crucially, universities expecting large amounts of the learning to be done on privately, independently, should quite clearly charge lower fees to the students.
Because they have less face-to-face contact with them.
Exactly.
So what about, so if the expectation by universities currently in the models that they tend to operate is that students must do a lot of self-learning, what about those students for whom that is not their learning style?
Yeah, so you're right. There will be students, and perhaps very intelligent students, who are more directed learners. So they benefit more from the tuition input. And for those students, there should be universities that provide a high quality amount of tuition and a large quantity of tuition for those students, so they can really reach their potential. And of course, the fee for that should be higher than the universities where there is lower amount of tuition provided, because most of the work is done as independent study.
Okay, so that's quite a revolutionary idea, considering where we currently are with university tuition, where you have a fairly standard amount that's being charged across the board. So how does your study help us think about how we might make changes to higher education?
Okay, so while you're right that the universities all charge very similar fees at the moment, what's quite striking is the universities actually offer quite different amounts of tuition. So even students studying the same course, when I was doing my PhD, I was teaching at Bristol, and I was also teaching at another university. And when I started teaching at that other university, the seminar classes were a lot larger, and so they were getting slightly different, a different bundle of tuition. And of course, students, when they're applying for university, it's not necessarily obvious how much tuition and the class size and so on. And at the moment, where I'm teaching now at the New College of the Humanities, tuition's again delivered differently in small Oxbridge-style tutorials. But in that case, there's also a different price for that university.
Okay, so another question in relation to your findings is, are you saying that maybe universities should have a system where classes are compulsory for students?
So there's big pros and cons for compulsory classes. In a standard neoclassical model, what's happening is that we've got a bundling of tuition and self-study. And so what that means is the students are forced to consume this bundle. And if, for example, they find that actually going for a class for an hour would be less beneficial to them than sit there reading a textbook for an hour, then of course they shouldn't be paying for that hour of class. So in that respect, having a fixed number of classes and making students attend them is kind of inefficient. And this bundling will distort the decision the students make. So they're getting tuition for, the marginal cost of tuition is just their time, because they pay a fixed fee for the whole bundle. And what this means is that the students make the wrong choices about how much to study relative to tuition in that case.
What's interesting about what you're saying to me is that there seems to be an assumption. The assumption seems to be that students make quite rational choices, which I think if anybody's experience of how students operate, that's not necessarily the thought process they're going through. So I guess my question is, how do you build into this model the fact that you've also got students who are going to university with different motivations, perhaps, than simply...
Sure, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. And in the other paper, the self-control paper, we actually look into this. And what we see from behavioural economics is the idea that students might have self-control problems. So this kind of suggests that they turn up to university kind of motivated, great intentions to study, but subsequently they fail to live up to them. And anyone that's been a student or that's taught students will know that this happens more often than you would hope. And of course, so students with those kind of procrastination problems, the paternalistic approach of compulsory classes would mean that the students are better placed to reach their potential. So on the one hand, you've got the compulsory classes might restrict students, but on the other hand, from a behavioural economics point of view, compulsory classes are really beneficial for helping students reach their potential.
Okay. Looking at these two findings in terms of the paper that you did on self-control, what changes do you expect might occur in higher education over the next decade?
Okay, so there's obviously been some changes already in respect to fees and new universities kind of entering the market. There's also been a big change in how universities or how higher education is delivered through massive online open courses.
MOOCs,
exactly. And I kind of think they're one of the big ways that higher education might change in the next few years. So the thing about a MOOC is it benefits from economies of scale. So you might have 10,000 students signed up. And so in that case, it's worth the lecturer putting, or the university putting, a lot of time and effort spent on providing very high quality lectures by the most talented staff across the world. But the thing about MOOCs is, first of all, you have to have some motivation to study, and the way we kind of talked about, students might not be that rational. So obviously they need to have more self-control. But on the other hand, not all material is suitable for that kind of dissemination through large online courses. So in our papers, we distinguish between the idea of core material that can be successfully taught in this way and discursive material, which involves more or is best taught in small groups. So in terms of how I think this can be integrated into higher education in the next sort of decade would be a hybrid model of the two, where universities have a lot of they rely on these standardized MOOC lectures for some of their core teaching, but they provide large amounts of smaller group teaching. And of course, this relies on the kind of idea that the accreditation of MOOCs is kind of solved. So that's getting a certificate when you pass it. At the moment, that's one of the big drawbacks of the MOOCs.
But what you're describing to me also it relate, you know, looking back to some of the points that you've made in your paper, is that would almost allow for a differentiation in fees, because if you could have people could decide how much of that more discursive time that they need and pay appropriately for that. So could it lead to a point where actually you do have quite big differences in how courses are priced based on what the learner feels they need?
Yeah, no, exactly. That's exactly what I'm thinking. The different universities will horizontally differentiate themselves. So they'll provide detailed information on the content that they provide the university, they provide the students, and then the students, when making a decision about which university to go to, will be able to make a more informed decision, taking into account how they think that they learn and what bundle of tuition they'll need and how much study they expect to do themselves.
Okay. What does the literature say about ability and self-study? Do you find that more able students are the ones that are happier to work independently?
Sure. So the previous literature, dating back to sort of Becker's work on human capital, suggests that high ability individuals should spend more money on education. So ability is hard to define. And of course, school teachers will tell you that ability is multidimensional.
Yeah.
And our model actually provides an intuitive extension to the definition of ability, comparing the costs of the inputs used to produce the level of education. So what that means is that when we're ranking ability, really, really it concerns what the price of tuition is. So, for example, if teaching became more expensive, the value of becoming an independent learner would increase. On the other hand, if tuition became cheaper, through MOOCs or changes in technology, then students who are independence will be less important for those students, and those students will kind of will crawl up the ability ranking. So the idea that that independence and ability are correlated, and therefore the most able students should be doing the most self-study, I don't think is necessarily correct. I think that the high ability students might be those, for example, that react well to teaching.
Mike, so could you just sort of summarise what you think are sort of the main takeaway messages from your two research papers into higher education?
Sure. So I think one of the points is that students might learn in very different ways, and they might also face different motivations and self-control problems. So taking into account that students learn in different ways, it's likely that the efficient way of different students acquiring education will be different for different students. So therefore, I'm kind of suggesting that the bundle of tuition might not be optimal for all students at all universities. And And second of all, the idea that individuals are multidimensional, and so the ability of an individual, how able they are, should really be thought of how the cheapest way or the least costly way of producing a level of education. And this means that it will depend on, for example, the price of tuition.
Okay. So it seems to me, in summary, is higher education sector should be putting more thought into treating their students in a more differentiated way.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mike. That was fascinating.
Thanks.